Sounds let me just turn good. My phone off. And
oh, yeah. Okay, I'm good.
Take off my watch.
There you go.
We don't get any... Gonna be hitting the start streaming button now.
Whoa.
And as long as sound works, that should be okay.
I see my little blips going up and down.
The happy, happy arts. All right. Cool. Well, now looks like everything's working. Everything's good. Everybody's got thumbs up. So let's do this thing. Hello, world, and welcome back to Street PX, a photography podcast. I know we missed that last episode, and some of you have been reaching out to me asking, are we still alive? And yes, we are. But I do want to apologize. I have been out on assignment for a couple, 3 weeks, kind of away from the mic, away from the computer. And a few of you out there are going, why didn't you set these things up in advance as other professional podcasters do? Well, I tried, and that kind of failed miserably while I was out there. Just kind of a little background. I just got done with a 2-week tour out on the inland waterways, the Middle America River system. And I'm out there documenting the crews of towboats and the towboat life and how hard that work is, and trying to shine a light on the industry, on an industry that otherwise goes very well forgotten, unfortunately, in this current atmosphere. But it's extremely important, and that's why I'm out there. So that was my first leg of this project, and I have a number of tours left to go. But in the future, once I step out onto the boat, I'll definitely make sure we have some shows in the pipeline and ready to send out to you. But that said, enough with my excuses. We are back again, and we're ready to kick this one off with a wonderful interview with Katie Jett Walls out of Washington, D.C. That's a great show. Before we get into it, though, I do want to knock out a couple of quick plugs. First one being is Street Photo is coming back again to the Bay Area, and that's just right around the corner, actually. That's going to be coming up on June 4th through June 10th, and this is the third annual. This is the third going of Street Photo, and it's just getting bigger and bigger, and I just want to express our congratulations and our bravos to Ken Walton, friend of the show here, with everything that he's built over there, and we are going to be a part of it. Not quite sure how yet. I do know that we're going to be helping put together some photo walks, so keep an eye out for that. The registrations will be coming up soon. There's great workshops from notable names, of course, Jeff Marmelston. There's Full Frontal for that crew is coming up. TC Lind and Andy Kochanowski. Iberia Next Perello. Many of you might know him from the Candid Frame, that podcast there. And there's going to be so much going on and so many people here that if you have the opportunity this June, we definitely recommend come to the Bay Area and check this out. We want to see you. We want to meet you. And who knows, maybe we'll find a place for you on our interview segment, our interview section that's going to be happening over at Harvey Milk Photo Center, which, by the way, is where all this is going to be happening. Additionally, I want to throw out a plug for a group that's near and dear to my heart, and that's San Francisco Street Photography Group. We have another exhibit coming up. And this is our second going. We had our first one back in 2016 that was called Exposed. It went well. We had lots of people come out and check it out. And we're going to be doing it again. We've already got all of the pictures together. We actually just got notification today that all of the prints have arrived and they look fantastic. The president of the group has already went down and picked it up in his Miata. So I have no idea how he got all those pictures in there. But this show is going to be opening there on April 13th over the Harvey Milk Photo Center. So we're very much looking forward to this. There's well over 50 images from photographers from right here in the Bay Area. All of the work is going to be focused directly on San Francisco. So if you're a Bay Area-ite, this is the place to be there on April 13th to take a look at this imagery. And who knows, you might end up seeing yourself there in some of these images. If you're part of that group, you probably will, because we got a really awesome section called, what was it? I forget what it is. Street Hogs in Action, I think. I think the working name early on was the Wall of Shame, because all of these are just snapshots of members of San Francisco Street Photography Group out there doing their thing. So yeah, April 13th, Harvey Milk Photo Center. Beyond that, I want to give a big shout out to our wonderful sponsor, Glass Key Photo. These guys have been so great to us over the last couple of years, helping us keep our mics hot. And we want to give that love back. So if you are in the Bay Area, this is San Francisco's premier analog photography store, the place to go for all things film. So you need a camera, you need film, you want to check out some zines made by artists right here in the Bay Area, go take a look down downtown San Francisco and say hello to all those guys over at Glass Key Photo, Gordon and Matt over there. Additionally, if you want to help keep our show going, you could always check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/streetpx, or buy some of our merchandise from the merchandise store right at streetpx.com. Click that little merch store link at the top, and you'll see a smorgasbord of camera designs and funny phrases and whatnot, all kinds of great t-shirts, and maybe even a barbecue bib if you want one of those. Anyway, enough of all this. It's time to get down into this awesome episode, this really great interview with Katie Jett Walls. A slight apology in advance. The sound did go a little south on us, and we did what we could to recover it, but it's just kind of the nature of it when it comes to some microphones out there. But we think that it's still well within reason for being able to listen to, and she's got a great story to share, so it's definitely worth it. So without further ado, our interview with Katie Jett Walls. No point in beating around a bush. We might as well just jump right into it. So hello and welcome, Katie, to our show.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Great. Fantastic. We're glad to have you on there.
Definitely. Now, I hear you're located in the old D.C. area, Washington, D.C.
That's right. I've lived here for almost 12 years, I think, which in D.C. makes you almost a local. A lot of people come and go shorter term, so sticking around more than 10 years gets you a little bit of credit. Still not a Washingtonian, but a little bit more credit than...
Sounds like San Francisco, doesn't it?
It's probably like that, yeah.
Yeah, everybody's a transplant, so it doesn't take long to be a local.
Yeah. Exactly.
And well, I mean, where you are, I think there's term limits on how long you can actually live in D.C. for some people.
Exactly. Yes. Sometimes your tenure in D.C. is limited by the election cycle.
Right. And there are times like now where we're glad about that.
Right. Yes. Fully in support of term limits.
Oh, so it being in D.C., we just had to get that little snarky comment.
Absolutely. Yes.
Now, where did you move from to get to D.C.?
I was living in Blacksburg, Virginia, with a good friend of mine. And before that, my family originally is from Alabama and Oklahoma. They kind of moved around a little bit. So I've been in the Midwest. I've been in the South. I moved to D.C. because I was dating someone who I am now married to. Okay. Yeah, and yes, exactly. When I moved up here, it's the first like big city that I've lived in, and I discovered I'm a city girl. So yeah, I'd always lived in small towns, but you know, the brownstones and the corner stores, all of those things. I really think it was Sesame Street, like in my psyche, taught me something about like to love cities. So when I moved here and saw that, I was like, I think this is where I belong.
I know that feeling all too well. I grew up with cornfields as being my neighbors, not people.
Totally. I understand.
I'm a total city boy, so yeah.
Hold on. Jim is born and raised urban, so
that's right.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, my little boy growing up, a city boy. So we'll see what he likes when he's an adult. Could be something totally different.
Nice. Kind of talking about your background, did you start photography after or before moving to D.C.?
Before. I had lived, when I was living in Blacksburg, when my grandfather passed away, I was 25 or 6, I think, and my dad asked if I wanted his old camera, and it was a Minolta SRT-201 film camera. Yep. The light meter was broken. So it was literally manual everything. And I learned how to use it. And I was driving through the mountains. Blacksburg is in the mountains. I drive through the mountains and learn how to use this camera. And it just occurred to me, like, wouldn't it be great if I could make money doing this? So a good friend of mine got married and moved away. And I was feeling sort of thrifting, you know, trying to figure out what I wanted to do with myself. And I decided to go to photography school. I was like 26 at the time, I think 27 maybe. And I thought that I needed to do that before I was 30, because like at 30, all you can't do crazy things or like change your plans or anything. You must be an adult at that point. So I had to do this before I was 30.
Oh, don't say that. That'll jade me. No,
right? No. So I'm 41 now, and I promise you can continue to innovate and do new things. But when you're 27, I don't know, you think maybe your time is almost up. But yeah, so I went to photography school. It was not a big deal school. It was in Oklahoma City. My grandmother lived there, so I had a place to stay and could keep my bills down. But I was in a year-long program. We spent tons of time in the dark room. We were shooting film. And it was it was an amazing experience. So
that's interesting.
Yeah.
Cause a lot of people, I mean, as photography goes, just like design and a few other, not everybody goes to school, and you have your hardcores on both sides. Like, no, school's a waste of time. Or the other ones, it's like, no, it's for the connections and the networking. And, you know, how did you find your experience?
So this was like a certificate program. So it wasn't the sort of school mm-hmm. where I walked away like with a network and connections necessarily.
Mm-hmm. Not the $100,000 art institute.
Exactly. Yeah. I was not at Brooks Institute. Is it Brooks Institute? Yeah. It was nothing like that. That was sort of what I envisioned, but what was really doable was something very small scale. But what I did get to do is spend about 18 months just focusing on photography and the understanding what I was making and how it all worked. And I love that I got to start with film. I feel like it's really dictated how I process my work now, even though I'm shooting digital. Like, I understand what I'm doing to my pictures.
Right.
And I understand what could be done in the dark room and what couldn't. So I can make decisions based on, maybe informed by that. So I finished that program, and, you know, it wasn't a stellar program or anything that I feel like I can really brag about, but I really loved it. And I moved back to Blacksburg after that and started photographing weddings and got,
Weddings are that's black and white. There's not really anybody that goes, yeah, weddings are okay. No, you either hate them or you love them.
Right. And, you know, I loved them for a while, and at some point, everything starts to look the same. Mm-hmm. And I think when you feeling like it doesn't matter what face, like I'm making the same photo over and over and over again, that's the point at which you need to maybe find something else to do. So, I had been photographing weddings. I was living in Blacksburg and doing lots of just like landscape photography and stuff like that. And then I met a guy. I moved to DC and decided I should do some family stuff too. And this was all like part-time job. I was also doing nonprofit fundraising. That was my day job.
Okay.
So I ended up sort of building a business. When my son was born 6 years ago, it seemed like a really good time to try to go full-time with photography. So I did, and it really
That's
worked.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's like, here's a kid, here's a financial, you know, new whale to toss money into. Let's go into photography.
Right. So what happened was, actually, the financial reality is you have to decide how much daycare is going to cost. So childcare is extremely expensive, and I worked in nonprofit fundraising, which is rewarding, but not financially. So, So childcare was going to cost about half of my salary, and I figured maybe I could make half of my salary with a photography business and be at home with the baby. And not only did
I was just going to say that's a good point to bring up, is the daycare price, because a lot of people just work for the daycare money.
Right. And I didn't want to do that. We gave it a try. And actually, within 2 years, I was making more than I had made in a salaried position. And now I'm 6 years in, and I don't think I could get another job making the money that I'm making now. So, I do a documentary approach, family photography.
Give a shout out to your company's name.
It's Red Turtle Photography.
All right. Everybody remember that. Red Turtle Photography.
Yeah.
I love that.
Thank you.
So a turtle fan then, huh?
Well, how did you come up with that name?
eBay. So back in the day when eBay really was really still people selling their used stuff, so I had this old camera and I needed some lenses for it. And I thought buying used on eBay would make sense. So I went on to make an account and I put in different like variations of my name. My maiden name is Jet. So I use 747 and stuff a lot. And Cat 747 was taken and Katie 747. And I think you'd get like three attempts and it would, the little window would pop up asking if you need help. I was like, okay, give me some help. And it said, I think it asked three questions. What is your favorite color? What is your favorite animal? And what is your hobby? So I answered them, red turtle photography. And it said, red turtle photography is available. Would you like this username? I was like, yeah, a great ring to it. Later, when I was
randomizer for the win.
Oh, yes, man, exactly.
the jokes that could come out of that.
You could end up with a lot of inappropriate business names.
Yeah. You know, I will say this though, that the approach is actually very similar to a designer's approach when working with a client, when it comes to branding or something. I'm a designer by trade. So whenever I talk with a new client about an identity kit, like a logo and their name or their company, I do have a questionnaire that sounds just as silly as can be. What's your favorite animal? What's your favorite season? What's your favorite color? And, but all of these things pull together so you can create a brand that the person will actually resonate with.
Exactly. I mean it would be fun to carry it further like that and see
because it could have also been like blue dog photography,
which
or
also sounds great. Like you almost can't go wrong. And I've actually seen other color animal combos, color animals in your business.
But now with your business, though, you're focused on families and children.
Right.
And what drew you to that away from weddings? I mean, I know the redundancy you're saying, but kids are not an easy thing to wrangle.
Kids are so much fun. Partly because they are unpredictable. So you always feel like you're working and thinking and problem solving in the moment. I think that's what I love about photographing with children. There's also no pretense. If you give them a minute to warm up to you, like they're not faking anything. I feel like you can get to genuine personality much faster than you can with adults. We have all kinds of stuff and things we're trying to project and ideas about who we are. Kids don't have any of that. I ended up just dropping weddings largely because of the time commitment, like all day photographing, but even more so like all week editing the same job. Which also started to feel really monotonous. Whereas, you know, if you spend an hour or two with a family or even an entire day, you're still looking at different stuff versus just like, here's the reception and they're still dancing. Mm-hmm. Oh, and some more dancing and still dancing. So
like a production line. It's gotta love presets.
So I made the shift. And I think also having a child myself, I was photographing families and children before I became a mom. But I feel like having a child myself, first of all, it put me more into a community of parents, which just broadened my networking and outreach. More people knew who I was. It was more people to talk to about kids and about photographing your kids. So that was pretty natural. But also like I could relate a lot better to other parents, to other moms. It was more interesting to converse with them. Besides, spent more time around kids. So when you have kids, you suddenly join a community of other people who have kids. So I still built in marketing. And it was about 2.5, maybe 3 years ago that I made a shift from shooting that kind of lifestyle pose stuff to shooting a documentary approach. And that I feel like just changed everything for me.
So now that's when you say you're creating these visual narratives.
I mean, the big difference between the documentary approach for family photography and what most people think of as family photography is I want to show up and just photograph what you're really doing. You don't have to clean your house, you don't have to change your schedule. I want to make good photos from the things that are really happening, your authentic family moments, which is pretty scary for a lot of people. People, they think they're boring. They think like, oh, nothing's happening. Like we just hang out at the house and the kids fight with each other and then we all eat some food. And what is there to photograph? But there's so much to photograph, which I think if you have, if there's a child in your life and you ever spend a minute photographing them, like we all obsessively photograph our own children. So why wouldn't you let a professional photograph your children in those real moments, right? Moms don't take their kids out to a field at sunset to take a picture. You take a picture while they're like pulling the toilet paper off the roll or like making cookies with you for the first time or something. You can elevate that. You can get a professional to make those pictures. And again, just like I said about chasing kids around and always having to be on top of your game and really thinking and planning what you're going to shoot in a documentary approach with families, it's the same thing. It's a lot of, you know, thinking and watching and waiting for the right moment, thinking about where you need to stand and how you move and how you make a photo from the things that are really happening, just the way a photojournalist is going to have to do in the field, whether you're a war photographer or you're just covering the car show downtown. You've got to be looking at where the light's coming from and anticipating. I think that's what we'll get to with street photography too, right? That moment anticipation,
yes.
And the way you're always like trying to predict what's about to happen. And then like that thrill when you get it right, when you're like, I saw this coming, it came, I got myself to the right place, the light was coming in the right spot, and I caught, you know, that expression or that funny gesture or, you know, the moment they toppled off the back of the couch or whatever.
It's that rush.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, yeah.
It's a creative rush.
Yeah. You just don't get that when you're literally telling mom, you stand here and dad, I want you to stand here. And mm-hmm. we're going to angle a little bit more toward the window and then I want you to hold the baby. And now everyone smile. Like there's no rush in that. You created it. You made it happen. It didn't occur in reality. I think,
you know, oh, no, I'm sorry. Okay. I was just going to say, it's interesting that you're talking about a documentary approach on many of these things. And there has been quite an uprise in documentary approach photography in a lot of things. And I mean, I'm sure that has a lot to do with the current age. And, you know, that's also probably why, excuse me, it's like street photography is really raging, is because everybody has this sense of the moment, capturing the actual moment.
Yeah.
And I think we've all become jaded to the posed a glamour shot, you know,
totally
go
agree.
To JCPenney and put your fist on your chin and tweak to the left.
Oh,
and
oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, here's a squishy toy or something.
Or the wicker chair behind you.
Oh, no. Actually, I still got a childhood picture, and I'm sure many of our listeners and you guys will remember this. Do you remember when it was a big deal to have in your portrait the kid sitting on the little wicker chair or rocking chair holding a ball, and then above him is the same kid, but it's kind of faded? Yeah, so you end up looking like this weird Monty Python, like personified moon above.
Yeah.
Oh, they were classy now.
The cliche. Oh my God.
But anyway, coming back to the kind of documentary approach and let's kind of transition into street. At what point did you just kind of start going, hey, I'm going to start taking candid photos of people in the street?
Yeah. So it was, let's see, early fall 2016. I just had a moment where I was so tired of photographing things that are pretty, right? Like, I mean, that's what my clients want and need. They want to see the beautiful side of their life. They want to see what they love, which is great.
Yeah.
So, and you know, children are beautiful, families are beautiful, but I sort of thought I'm going to die if I only ever photograph things that are just pretty. Like I'm so sick of it. I want to see what is gritty. I want to make a beautiful picture of something that's not pretty. I want to play with complex elements. Like I want to shoot in full daylight. I guess in August 2016, there was a Diane Arbus exhibit at the MoMA Brewer Gallery. I think that is. It's not the Museum of Modern. No, the Met Brewer. Sorry, the Met Brewer. And a friend of mine sent me a link, and we happened to be going up to New York for a week or so. And I abandoned my husband and child one day. I was like, I'm going to this exhibit. I'm going by myself. And I hate to say it, but that was actually the first time I had ever seen Diane Arbus' work at all. I knew who she was, and I had like read about her online, and I had seen some pictures and articles. had never seen an exhibit or even looked at one of her photo books. So I went to this exhibit, and it was a lot of her early work. And I just walked through picture after picture. I was obsessed. I mean, she's like an amazing photographer anyway. And she went out of her way, I think, to find people that were particularly unusual. And she even photographed them to emphasize what was strange about them. And something in me was just like, oh my God, Diana, get you, right? Like, get out of the box and like get into the world and go right up close to things that are so different from what you've experienced. And then the other thing that I loved about it was like to see New York, which I'm somewhat familiar with, but from 1950s and 60s. It's like, oh my God, like it's New York, but it's different, but it's the same. And just so not only was like there this layer of amazing photography, there was also a historical document. And I thought to myself, I am never going to be as good as Diane Arbus, but I could at least take some photos that 60 years from now mean something because they record how this place where I live looked then. And I happen to live in a part of D.C., like most of D.C., that's really gentrifying rapidly. And I live right off a street called Georgia Avenue. And a part of the street that is more or less neglected. It hasn't gotten a lot of attention in years and years and years. But suddenly there are developments kind of just north of us and just south of us. And you can feel it, right? You can feel that pretty soon the old barber shops are going to become spin, cycling, CrossFit, whatever. So I thought, what if I just started documenting Georgia Avenue? What if I just took pictures? And even if they're not great pictures, 60 years from now, when all of this is different, they'll say something about what used to be here. So I took my camera out and I started taking pictures and I loved it. I loved the feeling that I had a right to get into people's space, that like something in my head was like, I'm documenting this for the future. And you should stand here and let me take your picture. Right? You should be in front of your car wash and I can get closer to you. And there's no other reason on earth that I should be able to do that except that I'm documenting something important and you're a piece of this moment.
What was the reception?
Actually, not too bad.
Is that right?
Yeah. So every now and then someone would be a little bit, I don't know, embarrassed or walk away from me. I think in the first several months I was doing any street photography, I only had one person really, really upset with me. And I think she thought that I was photographing her out of maybe morbid curiosity, something that she thought was disrespectful, which...
You voyeur you.
Right. And really, I don't know, what people need to understand about street photography is like, I'm taking a picture of you because you look different. You look you look like better than average in whatever way. It's hard sometimes to convey that, but by and large,
there's something about them that's interesting.
Yeah. There's something about you that's interesting.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you're weird. I just think that you're like worth seeing more.
I'm going to use that line. You're worthy of my camera.
Yes. You're worth seeing.
Maybe I won't have to duck so many punches.
Totally. So, and then I learned a few other things. I learned that men love when a woman wants to take their picture. Really like it. And I love that Latino men seem to just be like, I thought that every time I would take a picture of a Latino man, the expression on his face was just like, I knew eventually someone was going to take my picture. It happened today. And like, thanks. So reception was good.
That's fascinating because there's a flattery.
Right.
They feel flattered. Yeah.
Right. And I think that maybe one thing, if we get to talk about what's different between women street photographers and men street photographers, is I think reception, how people see what you're doing, is somewhat different. I do think that a woman with a camera, for good and bad reasons, is seen as different than a man with a camera. I think that I can get into people's space a little more easily. At least that's, I don't have a problem getting into people's space most of the time. Reception was fine. And I found myself going out more and more and more and documenting farther up and down the street. And I guess a few weeks into this experiment, I had to travel to Denver. I had a client who had moved out there They wanted some family photos, so I flew to Denver, and I deliberately gave myself a free afternoon. And I told the friends that I was photographing with, they had been from D.C., so I said, where can I go that's like, you know, like Georgia Avenue? Like, I don't want to see the sights in Denver. I don't want to go to Union Station, I think, is their big train station downtown. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not what I'm after. I'm after that part of the city where things are still a little bit gritty, where you're not going to get hurt, but you might not be, a white girl walking down the street might not be the most typical person. Right. Yeah. And they immediately said, like, oh, I totally understand what you mean. Colfax Avenue is where you need to go. Colfax Avenue was perfect. It was exactly that. It was just a little bit neglected. It was a place that had a beautiful history. It used to be part of Route 66. And so, yeah, so, but it has fallen on hard times. And
is that the same place where you got that picture of the, like the four or five guys up four or five ladders?
Yeah.
Yeah. It looks like, it reminds me of working with sound and levels.
Yeah.
It's such
just
a beautiful
image.
Hanging
on my computer. It's right here.
Oh.
Yeah.
That'd be an awesome print.
Yeah. It's a really nice print.
So now I know Georgia Avenue and I guess Colfax Avenue is part of this project you're doing, American Streets.
Yeah.
So while we're on that subject, let's talk about that. You're saying that you're exploring cultural significance of the streets.
Yeah.
And that cultural significance maybe involves what you were talking about before, the change, how things are changing, how things are gentrifying,
yep,
evolving into something different, and you're trying to capture that moment that is now.
Yeah, and I have found a lot of cities kind of have this place that it might not always be a street, but often you can kind of find a street that's in this place where there's a tension between what's coming and what has been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can see it in like the different kinds of people on the street, how you can see the two sets of people, and there's kind of a clash of boundaries happening,
mm-hmm,
and a sense of change coming. And I feel like those are the places to me that are really interesting to photograph.
I know it because I can relate. I mean, in Chicago it's King Drive, where you have, it's a very historic neighborhood where it runs through a historic neighborhood where a whole lot of famous people used to live. But it can't, you know, like the story of a lot of urban centers, that, you know, it falls into disrepair.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it doesn't have the glitz and glam that it used to have.
Right.
But now things are coming back. But the problem is what happens to the people who are living there now.
Right.
You know, and that seems like what's happening with, excuse me, what's happening with Georgia Avenue.
Absolutely.
You know, along Georgia Avenue, the same type of thing, same type
Absolutely.
Of issue happening.
Yeah. And, you know, the people who have lived here for a long time have wanted additional resources and have deserved those resources. And you see, like, oh, there's no development, there's no new shops, there's no cleaning up the street, no grants awarded for storefront restoration or anything like that, until a developer puts up a condo and a bunch of 27-year-old young professionals buy the condos, and suddenly there's a new coffee shop and some restaurants and a dog washing place and revitalization. And you think there have been people living here all this time who needed and wanted and deserved the same kinds of resources, the same attention to the buildings and the storefronts. And I think how it would feel to watch that come for someone who's not you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know a lot, it's a challenge in a lot of cities.
Now, being in DC and doing street photography, being in kind of like the main artery for, politics and government.
Right, right.
Do you, like, I understand where you're located there on Georgia Avenue. How close are you to like all of that buzz and mayhem?
You're always close in DC. So physically speaking, I don't know, maybe it might be 7 miles down to the White House, but it might not be that far. And DC is a physically small city anyway.
Right.
And I'm pretty engaged politically. So the election happened right kind of in the midst of my discovering street photography. And like,
it did happen.
It did indeed. So like the first day, and I have to tell you, San Francisco is maybe the same way, but in Washington, D.C., 96%, I think it was either 94 or 96% of the vote went to Clinton, which means we could probably count on a couple of hands how many people made up 6% of the other vote. So you find yourself suddenly like walking through your city thinking, was it you? Was it you?
You pretty much ended up with like an unwanted guest to come into town and move in.
That's such a great way to put it. So yeah, there was a really deep sense of depression in Washington, D.C., like palpable for weeks. Uh-huh. It's still here, but we've kind of like figured out how to live normal life around this.
It's like watching a lot of Friday the 13th to get desensitized to violence.
Yes, that's it. You get desensitized to it. And you have to remember, too, that in D.C., our local news is everyone else's national news.
Right. So, yep.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's how it feels. You'll hear about something in the afternoon, and the next morning it'll be, you know, on the morning shows or something. But you heard about it yesterday, or maybe even the day before, or rumblings. Everybody knows someone on the Hill. I have clients who worked for Obama. So it all feels really close. That's why people in D.C. talk about politics constantly. It's just our weather.
Being in South Bay talking about Facebook. Yeah, it's just totally. It's part of the heartbeat of that area.
Totally.
Now, how has that affected your outlook on, because being in the heart of it, do you find that... I put it this way. It's if you work at like a particular factory that smells bad, the factory workers don't always smell it, but everyone else outside of it.
Nose like blindness.
You kind of have a situation where you're inside the box or inside that circle and it's difficult to get out. Do you find that affects your outlook on kind of the nation or the way that things are playing out?
I think yes. I feel like sometimes people in D.C. annoy people outside of D.C., or at least I notice this when I'm talking to friends who don't live here or family members, like, is this all you think about? Well, it's not really all we think about, but we do spend a lot of time talking about it. It's just, because, yeah, I mean, it's always in the air.
It's your industry. It's the nature of it.
Right. It's our stink.
All the politics stink. It's just different types of stink.
Right. So I think it was maybe 8 days after the election that I photographed my first protest. High school students all over D.C. had a walkout and marched to the Capitol, basically requesting that their values, they felt their values were not being reflected in the outcome of the election. And they wanted to be sure that their voices were heard. And I think looking back now at, the students after Parkland, there are a lot of young people really taking strong action. So it's cool to think the first protest I photographed was high school students. I have a beautiful photo that I absolutely love of a girl with a flag carried behind her. Her arms are up and she's got the flag hanging out behind her. And I just love that. It makes me feel like Bob Dylan songs or something.
That in and of itself is its own form of photography.
Yeah.
And you have to have a predisposition to be able to A, work within an atmosphere such as that, and B, be invisible in that atmosphere at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And there's this third layer of challenge, which is when you're photographing a protest, you have your own feelings as well. I photographed the inauguration protests, which outnumbered, I think, the inauguration visitors.
That might be the picture he was referring to as the actual protesters.
Right, yeah, he might have confused protesters with just regular attendees at the inauguration. But I was there, and there were a lot of protesters. And I photographed the Women's March the next day. And so in both cases, I'm sort of, part of me is there as a person participating in the protest or the march, a part of me is there as a documentarian. And I literally could feel my brain shift back and forth, especially during the Women's March. Sometimes I would just put down my camera and just be a woman at the Women's March. And then I would pick it back up and shift back into, like you described it, like invisible and trying to document really honestly what was happening.
When it comes to having those torn feelings, because you feel like you want to be present, you want to be involved and participate, but at the same time, while you're there, you also have the mentality of a photographer.
Yeah. Don't you think, though, as photographers, that one of the ways we are present is by making the pictures? Do you feel that way?
Yes.
Yeah.
Incredibly. Yeah. Because I always hear people say, oh, don't put the camera down because you have to be here and so forth. And I'm like, I am here. My brain here. And my memory works different than yours does.
Yeah.
I like to go home and get a beer and look at these pictures and then relive that moment again.
Right. And then share it with people who couldn't be there.
Yes.
Or have,
exactly.
Yeah.
Now, Katie, have you had an opportunity to photograph protests that are counter to what you believe? Like, I don't know, maybe pro-Trump? I didn't mean to say his name.
Well, but, no, I'm sure we've alienated
I'm sure we've
alienated our Southern demographic by now.
But, you know, but
listeners out there, I just want to note, it's all good.
Yeah,
we love all. It's just things happen. But
that's
yes,
right.
Go
that's
ahead.
True.
Yeah.
But have you had the opportunity to see that and maybe attempt to photograph those people?
So I have had two opportunities. The first was, when I photographed that inauguration, I was on the parade route. So it was literally protesters side by side with supporters who were there to celebrate. So I did photograph both. And I remember having a conversation with someone who suggested that who proposed that I was misrepresenting those with whom I did not agree with, that my photos were not a proper representation of them. And they said, you're supposed to be non-objective, or supposed to be objective, right? Not subjective.
Objective,
in your and I said, I'm not actually a photojournalist, right? Like, I'm not here with the media. I'm not shooting for Reuters. I'm shooting for me, and I am allowed for my thoughts and my biases and my beliefs to influence my photographs. That said, when I see someone wearing a white supremacy symbol flag around their shoulder, it's not biased of me to take a picture of them, right? Like, they're there representing what they feel, and my taking a picture of that and showing it, it's not biased. That really happened.
I saw a quote where you said making people own their own actions.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
I love that.
I did get in people's faces a few times. At inauguration, but they were making asses of themselves. And I felt like, if you're going to do that, and I'm going to put a camera in your face, you're suddenly responsible for yourself in a way that you weren't when you were anonymous.
A lot of people forget that street photography, a vein of that is taking a mirror and shining it back on society. It's like, this is what we look, or you, or we look like.
Yeah. So I have a picture of an older man who actually was screaming at a 10-year-old boy that the Democrats were the party of the KKK. It was a boy who, he was African-American or maybe mixed, but he had a no bigotry sign. And he was just standing there, 10 years old with his no bigotry sign. And some older guy is like getting in his face, telling him the Democrats are the party of the KKK. And I'm thinking, he's 10. He has no idea what you are trying to say to him. And you look awful. So I started taking his picture. And of course, he got very offended and was yelling at me that I had no right. And who was I and what was I doing? And I just kept snapping and sort of look up from the top of my camera. And I said, you're the one talking. So he eventually moved on. But yeah, I mean, I have these pictures of this angry face and this boy watching. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Now, can I flip this a little bit? Just because I want to talk about a project that seems to be near and dear to your heart, and that's the Grief Girls.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like just such a beautiful project. Talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So that's actually the first personal project that I ever photographed. And I say that, I mean, obviously, like, I photographed my son, and some people consider, you know, the photography you do of your own children as a personal project. I never felt that way about it. I always just was documenting our life. But the winter before I shot Grief Girls, I shot that in the summer. I had just started doing meditation, literally with the goal of making space in mentally to find out what kind of creative expression I might have. I always struggled with this question of, am I an artist or am I a craftsman? And I sort of fell on the side of, I'm a craftsman. Like, people hire me to take photos of their family. They commission me to produce a product for them. The same as if you were buying a handcrafted table, right? Like, I have the skill set and I do this thing for you and I sell it to you. And I felt like the difference between that and an artist was an artist photographs something that is coming from within themselves. It's an idea that you have. It's something that you see and you go and make it and present it for people to like or not like or think about. And I didn't feel like I was an artist, but I wanted to know if there was something more in there. So I literally took a meditation class. And within the time that I was doing that class, I was on the phone with my grandmother one day, and she made the comment that she couldn't talk long because it was Monday night. She was headed out for Dollar Taco Night with the Grief Girls. And I knew who the Grief Girls were when she said it. It's a group of women that she met when my grandfather passed away. They had all been recently widowed in about the same time, and they went to the grief group together. And I don't think at the time that they knew she used that term to refer to them, but she had always called them that, like, to us. And so I knew who, uh-huh. who this set of friends was. I also knew what Dollar Taco Night was. They go out to dinner at this place that has, like, tacos on the appetizer. And every Monday night, they're a dollar. And I think the idea is people come in and buy a bunch of tacos and some beers, or, you know, and some other stuff. But not the Grief Girls. Yeah,
that's the best kind of taco.
The Grief Girls go in, and they all buy one or two tacos and drink water and leave the five or six of them having paid $10 for dinner, which is not at all what the restaurant intended with their dollar taco night promotion. But they go out for tacos. So she couldn't talk long. I hung up the phone with her, and I was I was on the phone and driving. I've now admitted that. But I'm driving along, and I was like, somebody needs to take a picture. Taco night. And someone needs to take a picture of these women. Like, they've been friends now for 15 years. And I'm her granddaughter, and I know who they are, right? I know what they mean to her. I know why she meets with them as often as possible. And I just started thinking, like, would this be a project? Is this something to document? I started doing some reading about widowhood. And there's all kinds of psychological results of losing a partner that can lead actually to your life being shortened. So I studied a little bit about the psychological factors and how it influences longevity and health over time. And that one of the factors that mitigates shorter lifespan is having strong connections with other people. And often not with your family, not with your surviving family members, but with people who are outside of your family. I was like, oh my God, like, these ladies are keeping my grandmother alive. They're keeping each other alive. This is more than just dollar taco night, right? Like, this is how you survive a major life loss.
Yeah.
So I called her up one day, and I was like, I want to photograph you and the Grief Girls. Is that weird? Can I come? What do you think? And I really expected her to be like, oh no, that's crazy, terrible idea. I do not want to be a part of that. She didn't say that. She said, well, I don't know. Let me talk to them. And about a week later, they were all on board.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So my grandmother lives in Oklahoma City, and I flew out there and spent a week. And I arranged a time to spend a couple of hours alone with each of them. And then they scheduled some outings, including Dollar Taco Nights, for me to come along with. And I had no idea how you document, how you tell a story like this. So I just sat down with them. I literally, like, sat across from older ladies, most of whom I did not know very well. I knew my grandmother, but asking them, like, tell me about when your husband died. Tell me about, like, how long was he sick or was he not sick? What mementos do you have? Can I see pictures of when you got married? And so we had these really sweet, beautiful, sad conversations about this moment in their life. And then I would ask, how did you guys meet each other? I basically just sat there, like, with my camera, and I was, like, peeking over the top of it. And other times I just said, I'm going to talk and shoot. And we ended up making, I think, these really beautiful photos of the conversation that we had and the mementos that they keep. I talked with all of the other ladies before my grandmother, which was good. So I felt like I got in a flow before I had the one that was really kind of deeply personal.
Yeah.
And then we went to Dollar Taco Night, and I put it together into a photo essay. So yeah, that was the first sort of attempt at creating a project. And I think it's really nice.
Awesome. Are you looking at expanding that beyond just that group of grief girls and maybe like following along that? Yeah, go ahead.
I think one of the things that spurs you on for personal projects is the personal connection. So I don't know how deeply I could make a personal connection with some other group of people. I will brag a little bit here. Washington Post Magazine actually was interested in the story and wanted to publish the pictures, except they could only do stuff that's local. So since I had flown to Oklahoma City, it didn't fit in the like qualifications to be in Washington Post Magazine. So they did say like, oh, would you ever do something like this here locally? And I don't know, it felt inauthentic to like replicate a project. So I don't think that I would continue that one. That one feels done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, what, okay. It's a personal thing. Yeah.
You're talking about the grief girls in Oklahoma feels done? Yeah. You're not going to go, you're not going to do anymore. Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, in terms of, is that what you were asking in terms of maybe doing more with widows? Or do you mean doing
yeah.
more?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That one feels done. I feel like that was their story.
Okay.
I get you. Yeah,
but you're looking, but you're not right now. You're looking for partners to now. What's that about?
Yeah, so that is what it says on the website. We were hoping to find an avenue for publication, and so I always leave it up on the website. Like, if anyone's interested in telling the story,
well, let's put it out there.
Exactly.
I would love that. Yeah, I mean, Americans are getting older, so facing widowhood is a pretty common situation. And I think it's good for people to know what it entails, what it looks like, and what are the things that you can do to have a better experience, a happier and longer life when you find yourself in that situation.
Well, if anybody out there that has a publication, New York Times, wink, wink, hey, if you are interested. We'll definitely have the contact information in the show notes.
New York Times is always listening to this podcast.
I know. I'm getting a callback for the New York Times portfolio review this year. But then I heard a lot of other, like, really actually famous photographers who also didn't. So I don't feel so bad now.
Well, we did find out that Kodak listens to us, I think. Ooh. At least that's what I'm telling myself. We had an episode where we were demanding they bring back T-Max 3200, and then a few months later they did. We were like, yeah, we did.
Totally. All you. Congratulations. Yes. Like, that's a big win, guys.
Yeah, yes. We worked with a company that was on a death rattle. But I want to come back to the grief girls thing and transition off that. We were talking before the show about women in photography, and we wanted to really jump into that topic.
Yeah.
I'll let you just kind of run with it there.
Sure. I love that you segued from the Grief Girls Project to women in photography, because I think one of the things that now guides some of the choices I make about personal projects is what perspective can I bring to the table that maybe hasn't been explored yet. And I think in many cases, the way that women look at the world, both at other women and at experiences people are having in the world, might be different, right? Like, there might be a different way of seeing. And by putting up barriers to having women document stories, whether it's through photojournalism or through personal projects, those barriers are actually limiting a way of seeing from being out there in the world.
It's a whole perspective lost.
Right. And we are human beings. And if you are kind of hobbling half of the human experience from being shared, then you're not fully capturing the human experience, right? Like, if only men are taking pictures and only men's pictures are getting out into the world, there's half the population's view of human life that's quiet, that's stifled in some way. And I don't think that does anyone any good. Like, we're all humans. Let's have a full experience, and let's let the pictures out there in the world represent humanity, not half of humanity, or not half of humanity plus like the 10 women who are willing to push and work in the world in a masculine way in order to get that the kind of recognition that they want to have. So, you know, I think Grief Girls is a good example of that. I don't know if I can't say, I'm not going to say no man would be interested in that story, but I think that as a female, I was attuned to my grandmother's experience in a particular way. And I saw the importance of those female relationships. So it was a story that I could tell. And I think as a woman, I could tell it in a way that's different than a man might tell it. And I think it's different than, I don't know that a man would see it.
Well, it's a natural thing. I mean, you think about father-son relationships or mother-son or father-daughter relationships, all of these dynamics always, we'd be liars to say that they're not different.
Yeah.
They are. That is just on the base foundation of it. That doesn't negate it being good or bad. It's just a completely different way of approaching a relationship and deriving any type of expression from it. And you being able, you being in your position working with your grandmother, I wouldn't say that a guy wouldn't be interested necessarily, but I truly believe that he would not, a man would not always be able to capture it in the same way and vice versa.
Yeah.
I know when I'm faced with grief, I'm supposed to shake it off, you know.
These are the social norms. It's like, there's no crying in baseball.
Exactly, you know. I don't want to characterize all men like that, but you know,
I agree.
A lot of us.
Well, it's
like
not necessarily
that,
a characterization. It's just it's societal norms.
Right.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And like we were laughing about before the episode, because we were talking about this, and we were laughing because I know us with Street PX, we have a big interest in bringing more women onto our show for guests and for interviews, but some places kind of take it like today's special episode. We have a woman, and it's like that's not how you kind of change the dynamics of things.
Yeah.
You just treat it normally. It's doesn't have to be a special event,
right? In fact, you should do it often enough that it's no longer a special event, right?
Right.
It's like, nobody's interested in the fact that you chose a woman to interview, because it happens often enough.
Yeah.
But it's not a thing.
Now, that's notwithstanding today is, as recording with you here today, kind of is a special day because it's International Day of the Woman. But that wasn't...
apart from the cosmos making it happen.
that's just all the planets aligning perfectly for us today. but something else you had made a mention of was the difference, this topic of male gaze versus female gaze. I'm really curious as to what you meant by that.
Sure. So there actually was an amazing conversation about this topic on the Women in Streets Facebook group. And if people want to look that up, it's @ Women in Street on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And somebody raised the question about, do you think that the male gaze is a real thing? And what does it mean for street photography? So I did something amazing. I actually looked up male gaze so I could find out where the term came from and what did the person who coined it actually mean by
Wikipedia.
Right. I was like, let's learn a little bit before I put my opinion out there. I'm by no means an expert, but it was coined by a woman who was an academic in film studies. And she was observing that in films, female characters are most often supportive, and they kind of fall into some stereotypical roles. They're the mother of the protagonist, or the girlfriend of the protagonist, or the wife of the protagonist. The protagonist is a male, and the women are essentially props in telling his story. So the concept of male gaze isn't so much like men take pictures of beautiful women and women take pictures of everyone. It's not that. It's the idea that we're all conditioned to see the world in a certain way, and that culture as a whole often assigns females into a supportive role in a male story. So the conversation played out in the Facebook group. You know, there were a lot of women who said, well, I don't think this is a thing. I don't photograph as a woman. I don't go out as a photographer and think about what's my female approach. And a lot of women photographers have all different kinds of styles when they're working. Some are comfortable being more aggressive or inserting themselves into a situation where others are more contemplative. And we all agree that wasn't gender related. You can see the same thing in male photographers. So what was this idea of male gaze versus female gaze? And we actually came down to the fact that it seems to be more just the water that we swim in. The fact that even as a woman, whether I'm approaching a subject aggressively or passively, the way that they see me as I approach for the picture is going to be completely different than the way they see mm-hmm. either of you. And I'm yeah. guessing both of you will have different reactions as well when you approach someone, because again, mm-hmm. the water that we swim in. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you can't escape the idea of the male gaze. Like I said, like men letting me photograph them and kind of acting like, yeah, you probably wouldn't get that same reaction, right? When you're photographing. Right.
Well, I mean, I hope not.
Right. I mean, some neighborhoods maybe, and well, go you.
I've gotten it. It's few and far between. But yeah. you're right, though. There is a different reaction in many cases to it. And kind of more to your point, there's actually there's a term for it. There's a study rather for it in movies in a filmmotography where it comes down to how long does it take for the woman to talk about the man or.
I don't know if I'm saying it yes. right. Yeah, the Bechdel test.
I think that's it. It's like if a group of women are together or a group of men are together, it's the study of are they actually talking about a topic that is non-gender bias, or is their script all dedicated to supporting the male character elsewhere, somewhere else in the film?
Right.
And they have this kind of rating system on movies on how that plays out. It's right. very, very interesting.
Hmm. Yeah.
So yeah. What was the study that you said it again?
Bechdel.
Just for our listeners.
I think I'm saying Bechdel it.
Bechdel
right?
test.
The day yeah, you just heard was my husband texting me the link in Wikipedia. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Yeah. And so you would think, and he just texted mansplaining.
So. Oh, this is going great.
So yeah, I mean, so it would be interesting to see what, you know, what applications you could make in street photography. One of what I see is women photographers' voices are not given primacy. You know, I mean, like those lists, like, and here's our list of top women photographers. That's kind of the same thing, right? As the women in films
yeah.
being supportive of male protagonists. Or it's a big deal, right? Like, oh, we made a movie about Wonder Woman.
Right.
Yeah.
It's more the outside looking in. Mm-hmm. When you know that there's a problem is when something gets made and everyone is not talking about the story or the production of it. It's the topic of, well, think Black Panther on the same concept. It's like, here's this movie. It's a great movie, but everyone's talking about the nature of the film and having all Black actors and actresses. And that's awesome. But we have a problem when that is the topic of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a problem in Hollywood when it's not yeah. that the movie is good. It's that the movie has this aspect to it. And it's like that shouldn't be the topic. That this is 2018.
It should no longer be strange or unusual to have.
Right. Just example, like the Wonder Woman thing you're talking about.
Or women street photographers featured.
Yeah,
exactly. Festival. Yeah.
Uh-huh, right.
Yeah, it's just, that would be nice. I look forward to getting to the time where it's not a big deal. Where in the women in street group, we're not saying like, oh my God, they put a woman on the Milan Street Festival.
Right.
What are you going to think?
Yeah.
So it would just be like.
It's like, no, they put Katie up there. That's awesome.
Right, exactly. You could just be like, I love this photographer. I've been following this photographer for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, but
I think we'll get there. I have a high confidence we will.
I'm seeing a lot of movement in that direction. I'm glad to say I have a photographer friend in New York, Jennifer Tonetti Spellman, who was just had an article about herself in Fuji Love. And
nice.
Julia Coddington has been doing a lot of speaking. I think she's a speaker at the Milan Street Photography Festival. I hope I'm not misspeaking. One of them coming up soon, though. Julia also just started a collective in Australia for women photographers.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of women that I've been following for quite a while starting to push the boundaries. And we're just doing it ourselves, you know, trying to put ourselves out there. Just like me emailing you guys and saying, I would like to be on this podcast. It's great. And let's talk.
I'm so glad you did.
Yeah, at some point, you just have to, right? I mean,
yes, you do. Yeah, you got to put yourself out there.
Yeah, and that's how male street photographers do. So
yeah, guys ain't got no problem with it. So
yeah, that's the thing. So I had such a fun little like lesson when I was in Puerto Rico in January, and people in Puerto Rico drive. I was warned, like, drive very aggressively. Particularly at intersections, there are no rules about who gets to go first. You know, in the States, it's sort of like whoever arrived first, unless you're making a left turn. There's all sorts of little kind of unspoken rules when four cars arrive at an intersection. In Puerto Rico, whose turn it is who wants it most. So you get to an intersection, and if you want it most, you go, and everybody lets you. So I learned really quickly, and I told my photo partner for that project, Ania, I was like, oh, I get it. When you get to an intersection, you just drive like a man. You just drive like a man and say, I'm going. Like, you haven't moved and you haven't moved, I'm moving. Or if someone else is already moving, you'd be like, all right, bro, you got this, then I'll go after you. So I thought, like, why can't I approach more of my photography with that kind of sense of confidence? Like, it's okay. I can email and say, I want to be on your podcast. You know, you can just, it goes to whoever wants it the most. And again, there's no reason to let our gender hold us back from that either.
Damn straight. That's truth.
Now, Katie, are you heavily involved with Women in Street, the group?
So I'm not heavily involved, but I follow it regularly. They do monthly themes. So there'll be a topic and you can share two photos. And then at the end of the month, Her Side of the Street publishes a curated set. They invite a different person each time to choose usually 15 or so photos from the hundreds that get submitted. So I always submit some, and I think two times I've been included in the final selection, which is awesome. I participate in discussions. I've never published anything with them other than just getting selected in a couple of those monthly themes.
Okay, I meant Her Side of the Street. That's it. I think I said Women.
Her Side of the Street is the organization, but at Women in Street is the Facebook group.
Oh, I see.
That is connected to it. Does that make sense?
I see. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and we'll definitely be putting a link to that in the show notes because you have to check it, at least the website, and then there's the Instagram feed and everything. It's amazing.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
I really hate to do this because we're short on time, but I wanted to get one more topic in. You had alluded to Puerto Rico just a moment ago.
Yes.
And you have a great, you have a fantastic project called Save Our Souls.
Yes.
Is that from in January?
Yeah.
So it's a new project. Talk about that real quick because that's beautiful, the way that you put all this together.
Thank you. So after a few weeks after the hurricanes hit the Caribbean, my good friend, Ania Lanyaro, who is the partner that I photographed in Puerto Rico with, Ania had an opportunity to photograph in Dominica with the UN, but paperwork and things that needed to happen before she could go didn't happen in time for her to make that trip. And I was disappointed for her, and she was disappointed. And it just occurred to us again, like, we don't have to wait. Projects go to who wants them the most. Why can't we go anywhere we want? We don't need someone's permission or sanction to go photograph a story. So we decided Puerto Rico made a lot of sense to be the place that we wanted to visit. We've never put together a project that involved travel. Both of us do street photography and make our money from Shishi's weddings. I photograph families, but we both do street photography and really have a passion to branch out into documentary. So we had to figure out how to fund a project like this, how to afford to go, how the hell you find the stories or get access to the people that you want to work with so that you're telling a really intimate, powerful story, not just a cursory, I visited Puerto Rico story. So we did our homework. We worked really hard. We ended up connected with a fixer. I really love saying that I worked with a fixer. Mardelis Justino is a journalist in San Juan.
What's that name again?
Mardelis Justino. And through a contact at Washington Post, actually, we got in touch with Marv Ellis, and she helped do the legwork, finding the people that we could shoot with. She pitched a few different ideas. We said, this is where we feel we need to go. She arranged everything and also came with us and acted as a translator. So, yeah, we flew to San Juan. We raised over $3,000 through GoFundMe to fund the project. We flew to San Juan in January, and we spent a week. Marv Ellis took us to a little town in the mountains called Hialeah, and we met the administrators at a high school there, and the staff at that high school there's no other way to say it than that they have saved the lives of the families of their students. They went to the home of every student in their school, about 700 or 800 students, personally, to find out if everyone was okay after the hurricane, to take food, to carry water. They had students coming in even before there was power and water. In fact, they only got electricity about a week before we visited, almost 4 months post-hurricane, power at the school. We spent 2 days in Hialeah, and then Marv Ellis took us to Cantera, which is a slum in San Juan, which really doesn't have great resources at the best of times, but post-hurricane was quite worse. And then we spent 2 days in Orocovis, which is another town down in the mountains. So each of those days our goal was to tell a really intimate story about what people were experiencing now, all these weeks and weeks after the hurricane, still waiting for resources, power still not available, water sometimes not still available, just what life looks like when help has not come. And it was one of those things that's both the hardest thing I've ever done and the most amazing thing I've ever done, to spend 1 week doing nothing but taking pictures. There's nothing on my to-do list but take pictures, edit pictures, sleep, and eat some food. And working,
but also getting in with the lives of these people. I mean, you, from looking at the images and the stories that you derive from them, or you caption under them, it looks like you were able to get very kind of intimate relationships with learning about who they are, what their experiences have been.
We were very fortunate. Part of that was because we were working with Marv Ellis, who is a journalist, and lived there. So she would ask her initial questions. Were already so insightful, more than we would know to ask. So our questions were follow-ups on her really insightful questions. And then we had time with her to ask that story and learn more. But yeah, working with Marv Ellis gave us really deep insight right away. But I will tell you this, people are so forthcoming. When they feel that someone is really there to hear their voice and potentially like let that voice get out into the world, people will tell you what's going on with them and what they're hoping for and what they're afraid of. Point your camera and shoot.
Especially for a nation that feels so ignored by
rightfully
the rest of its own nation.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have some good leads at possibly getting that published. We were able to speak with a photo editor at Reuters, who looked through the work and was very complimentary of it, gave us some suggestions, and may be able to point us toward publication. That's what we hope. We would hope that those people were so gracious to share their stories. And it's hard to tell somebody, like, your story deserves to be photographed by a capital S somebody. And I'm not that. And I don't know if anyone will listen. I'm not the
That's
photographer.
That's a damn shame, too.
Right?
You don't have to be capital S somebody to actually be able to put together a story that will resonate.
But you do to get it out there.
Sad to say.
Yeah. Except Ania and I are determined that that isn't true. That you can make your own story and you can push it out into the world. We just have to figure out how it's done.
Make that right turn.
Exactly. Those who want to
go. Yes, hit the gas. That's fantastic. Well, I know everybody's got schedules to match and everything. So I'm going to go ahead and let's spin off of that travel topic there, and I'm going to toss it to Jim for our last question.
Well, this is a question we ask everybody on the show, Katie. If you had the opportunity to go anywhere in the world at any time from the inception of the camera to just a photograph, where would that be?
Well, you make it extra complicated when you add time travel.
Yeah, that's the point.
We're all sci-fi around here.
But it could be in the present. It could be in the present.
Okay,
I think I know where you want to go.
You say, oh, I bet you don't. Maybe you do.
I don't.
Vietnam. You did know.
I did know. Yes, I did.
I want to photograph in Vietnam. So can this time travel scenario allow me to actually, can I hop in time? That's what I want to do.
I want to go
to Vietnam, and I want to photograph before the Vietnam War. I want some sort of magical power to keep me safe and photograph during the war. And then I want to photograph after. Wouldn't that be amazing to go back in time and tell just your own self, tell a historical story, right? Rather than one photographer photographs for this decade and another photographer here, and it requires many people to tell a story over time. Like, oh my God, if you could photograph, I don't know, half a decade, half a century.
So why Vietnam?
Just purely selfish. I've never been to Asia, but throughout Asia, I see photos of people seem to live outside more than I think in the U.S. And maybe we did more at some point. I think people were out in the streets and neighborhoods more than they are now in their house now. But a place where there's life and activity outside, I see photos from Vietnam, and I'm just like, I just want to be there. There's these people everywhere, and they're close, and they're just doing their business in the streets, and everything's happening around you. I just like, I want to be in that energy, and I want to see, you know, the light and the action and the constant change, and I want to catch those moments over and over.
Nice. We had a past guest that spent 3 months around in Vietnam, Cambodia, kind of that whole area. And that was one of his takes on it, was how much more people are outside and communicating with their neighbors and being a part of the community, as opposed to wrapped up in their house or on their phone, on the computer.
Yeah. I do love to go to Chinatown in New York City, where there's, you know, the street vendors are out, and there's just a lot of bustle. So I know that's just like a shadow of really going overseas. But yeah, any place I think people are out living their lives in public, where it's not, people or children are playing, right? Nobody sees kids anymore.
Yeah.
So I think that's on my list of places I want to go.
Awesome. That's good that you had specified being in the city and stuff rather than, you know, upstream and end up like Dennis Hopper from Apocalypse Now. All these cameras and no film, just completely batshit crazy.
Right. I see the danger. I see how you could slip into that.
Nowhere to do any processing, you know?
I do not love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Now, I didn't bring up the improv thing, but I'm kind of wishing I did. Do you do improv? Because I am a researcher.
Yes. In fact, I'm going to tell you, there's no better way to train for shooting street photography than to do some improv. My husband founded an improv troupe at his college 20 years ago. And when he and I started dating, one of the first dates he took me on was to see some improv here in Washington, D.C., where it's actually really great improv.
And you were like, shit, I went in on that.
Oh, my God. What just happened? Like, I don't get how they're doing this or what's going on. So he's like, oh, let's go take some classes. So we took some classes. And I'm like, oh, I understand now. Like, this is genius. They're literally making up stories in the moment. And as photographers, right, we know what it means to be in the moment.
Yep.
But when you've done some improv and you get used to sort of, I don't know, responding to people you're around. When you're doing street photography, it's improv, right? Like, you know how many times I've been like, what are you up to? And I'm like, oh, sorry, I'm a tourist, and this is my first time in New York, and it's so cool, I'm sorry. I'm just like playing a role, right? I never say like,
you're performing,
and you need to just back off because my pictures are amazing.
It's coming really, on strong.
Right, it's really handy for a lot of things to be
That's
able to,
so great, though.
No, it really is, because my wife took improv classes.
Yeah.
She's an instructional designer, and she also presents in front of classrooms for adults. And she took improv.
Yes.
And she loved it. And I never took it, but I was photographing an improv class.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get on that stage so bad. I mean, you get that feeling. I wanted to get up there. I know what I would have said in that. You know, it was like, oh,
you're like, I know.
Well, I probably if I had been on the stage, I would have frozen like a deer. Looking at that.
I always tell people, but it's like good improv is like when you're sitting around a table with people you know so well, and the conversation is just flowing, and you're kind of finishing each other's sentences, and every other word is an inside joke. You throw out the movie quote and everybody laughs. It's like that kind of energy. Like it just starts happening and clicking, and you're almost reading each other's minds. And it's really, really fun when it works. Now it's super embarrassing when it doesn't work. You do a show.
Oh, that's true.
Like, that
I completely know. I married into a theater kid troupe. My wife was in theater. She went to Stevens College. And
this explains why you were interested in that improv bit.
Yes. Oh, yeah. But it's one of those things. When you marry somebody that's a theater kid or an improv troupe, you're not just marrying them.
Oh, right.
Yes, that's right.
You're kind of marrying the group
that come with them.
Which are, but you led to it right. The improv, the performance aspect of it makes a huge difference on the back end for photography or for film or what have you. It's the ability to be able to interact and think quickly.
Yeah.
In the moment.
Right.
You know, and that helps you visually in your visual interpretation of the world.
Right. Well, like we were talking about predicting what's about to happen. I mean, that's part of improv too, where you're like, you realize, oh, I know where you're going. I know where this is going, and I'm ready to be there with you.
If it doesn't go where you think it's going to go, you can react.
Exactly. You pivot.
Yeah. Yeah. You pivot. And that's improv.
Exactly. Yeah. So inscribed inside my engagement ring, yes, and?
It is.
It is.
Yes. Oh, that's so awesome.
I called it. Yes, and.
That is the improv motto. Yes, and.
Yep.
It doesn't matter what that other person says, run with it. If you ever watched Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Yep.
And I mean, that is a perfect example of improv. I mean, obviously commercialized, but nevertheless, the foundation is there.
Absolutely. My husband just texted and said, tell them our son's name is Dell. If you guys know anything about improv, do you know who Dell Close is?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So our son's name is Dell.
Well, as an aside, what's the theater troupe that he put together? Do they perform, or is there anything you want to bring up? Because I could always add this in as bonus material, because this is amazing.
He was dying. Yeah, so the troupe that he founded is called Colson the Stage Monkey.
Wait, what?
You heard me. It's Cult of the Stage Monkey.
That is brilliant.
Yep, it's his name.
Cult of the Stage Monkey. And please say there's a link to this.
Oh, Zach, is there a link? Wait for the ding. He's probably
fucking bling. Go ahead with what you're gonna say though while he does that.
Oh yeah, so there was they were a college troupe, and they had a member at one point who transferred to some other college and wanted to create like a satellite troupe there, and this school wouldn't let them use the word cult in the group. Like they wouldn't approve them for university approval, so they're just the Stage Monkeys. Because they couldn't use the word cult.
See, when I think Stage Monkey, I think about the ones that, during setup, and my mind is completely blanking the word strike.
Yeah,
it's the one that it's the monkeys that have to like build shit and then take stuff down, and everyone else goes home or goes out for drinks.
So my husband was a theater tech. Yeah, he did theater tech stuff, and a bunch of the other guys that originally founded, they met each other. Yeah. Through theater stuff, and they did theater tech in college. And that was kind of that. That's exactly the reference to Stage Monkeys.
Ah, okay.
Oh, so my husband texted you can look up Silverback Improv Theater, And that's like the off-campus troop of all the old-timers. Like the people who were in the troop, in the college group, they are adults now, and they have this group called Silverback.
Awesome. So you just keep staying with the ape kind of references
and
all this stuff.
Following up with just keeping the monkey idea going.
Yeah.
But that's perfect for improv too. Though I mean, you just—it's completely unscripted and unexpected,
right?
Just like monkeys,
just like street photography. Right?
Yep, and you never know. You'll be there watching a show, and then poo gets flung at you.
Right. That, you know, that just turns a lot of improv shows. Like,
shit. Not real shit. Just, you know, maybe some rubber shit. you got to go to Tahiti or somewhere else.
Right, to get the real stuff. Oh boy.
Excellent. Well, Katie, thank you so much, and I know our listeners would love to see more of your work. So go ahead and let us know some good links to be able to find more about you and more of your portfolio online.
Sure. Thank you. So as I mentioned, my family photography is redturtlephotography.com. My street project are living right now at katiejetwallsphotography.com, and that needs to be updated. My Instagram is at katiejetwalls, and that one's pretty up to date. And then the Puerto Rico project is at saveoursouls-pr.com.
Awesome. Awesome. And before I get to you, Jim, I also want to note too, just as we had talked about in the opening, because we're going to record that later. Katie does have an exhibit coming up in Bethesda, Maryland. That's going to be on July. What day is that?
I think the opening is going to be July 8th.
July 8th, and that's running for how long?
I think a month. We have a meeting in a couple of weeks.
Perfect. So it's kind of in its infancy stage.
Right.
Okay. So that's going to be at Glen Echo Photo Works. And this is it called The Miraculous in the Mundane?
Correct.
Awesome. Yes.
Yeah, he's on top of everything.
Yes. Yeah. So and this is a collaboration, and I need to say it's with Ania Lenaro with her family work and Chelsea Silveris, who also is a documentary family photographer. They're both amazing, and the three of us together put together this show.
That is sweet. Thank you for bringing that up too. That's very specific. And I will be adding links not just for Katie, but also for Ania. And what was the other name again? I'm sorry.
Chelsea Silveris. And
there it is.
The spelling.
That'll be great. So you want to go to our show notes and check all of this out. So if you happen to be driving, don't be riding. just go to Street PX later. Now, Jim, where can we find out more about you?
As always, at jimwatkinsphoto.com, and all the links to my social media platforms are right there.
All right. And you can find more about me at recasper.com. That's where you'll find all of my blog posts, all of my workshop information. I do have a workshop coming up in Mexico. So if you want to join me, there are still tickets available. Additionally, if you are enjoying the show, definitely check us out on iTunes. We love stars. We love reviews. It helps us get into more ears out there. And if you want to help support Street PX, because every dollar that comes in through our Patreon or through our merchandise store go right back into keeping the mics hot and the bandwidth flowing. So go check us out at patreon.com/StreetPX. And we are, as just like this particular show, we are now live streaming a lot of our interviews. So as a Patreon contributor, you will get access to our YouTube channel. And it's all professional looking and cool. And we got a little slideshow up of the guests that's all their pictures popping around and all kinds of fun shit. So go over to Patreon and throw some money our way and help us become a better show. So again, thank you so much, Katie, for being on.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks. This has been great.
This has been wonderful. And thank all of you out there for listening. And we will talk at you again in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Awesome. Beautiful, thank Katie. You so much.
Beautiful. Oh, thank you. That was fun.